Hello and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, the podcast in which we talk about one overrated and one underrated movie within the same genre, style, tone, or however we see fit. This is Oktay Ege Kozak.
And I'm Ryan Oliver.
So in this episode, we do every once in a while we do our director's episodes, which means that the films are the picks might not have much to do with each other stylistically or when it comes to plot or story or anything else, but they share the same director. And in this case, we have two movies that couldn't be more different as far as the genre or the story or anything else really is concerned. But they share a director, and the director is Gore Verbinski. So these picks kind of make sense because Verbinski is a pretty brave director when it comes to versatility. The guy has tried pretty much any genre you can possibly think of, all the way from like J-horror, Japanese horror remake to weird full CGI animated feature and everything in between. So the picks for this episode are Ryan's, and Ryan picked The Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, the first one, as overrated, and the movie that Gore Verbinski did in between the first and the second Pirates movies as sort of a palate cleanser, I guess, and that is the Nicolas Cage dramedy, The Weatherman. That's Ryan's underrated. But first, let's start out with Pirates of the Caribbean, and the new one is out, so it's in the kind of in the zeitgeist now, even though it's kind of already forgotten after like a week. It didn't make much of a cultural splash, the fifth one that just came out. But anyway, Ryan, why'd you think Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl as overrated?
This dock is off limits to civilians.
I'm terribly sorry, I didn't know. If I see one, I shall inform you immediately. Apparently there's some sort of high-toned and fancy to-do up at the fort, eh? How could it be that two upstanding gentlemen such as yourselves did not merit an invitation?
Well, this might be a bold statement because these movies are mostly beloved. I'd at least say with audiences, at least the first three Gore Verbinski directed movies, and I don't think they're totally meritless. And what I'm about to say is gonna make it sound a little bit more negative than I really am, but I truly do believe that this franchise as a whole, after the Transformers movies, this is probably the worst mega budget franchise. Like, there are worse franchises, but like the ones that are made for $150-200 million and gross $1 billion worldwide, like after Transformers, which are like the you lift the barrel, and then there are those movies, and then like the bottom of the barrel would be Pirates of the Caribbean. for me, I've never really liked these movies all that much. I think there are some interesting stuff in them, but I find each new film to be more bloated, more convoluted, more nonsensical, and I never really liked this first one to begin with. Though watching it this time, I will credit Gore Verbinski because there were things that I was kind of looking forward to seeing in this movie that I could remember. And then I realized they were actually in the sequels, weirdly enough. I was looking for, I was like, oh, I like the design on Davy Jones. And I was like, wait, oh, he comes in on the second one. And then I was like, oh, so that means the weird Being John Malkovich-esque scene is not in this movie either, where Johnny Depp's Jack Sparrow is in Davy Jones' locker, so I guess, and there's like multiple versions. So like, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess you're in a position where let me tell you something about where I come from with, for example, the Transformers movies. Like, people always say, oh, the first one is the good one and the rest of them are crap. And like, I can't make out any difference between those two. The first is just as shitty as the second one or the third one or the fourth. They're all interchangeable to me. And when it comes to Pirates franchise, it feels like even people who really love the first movie, a lot of people who are really into the franchise even would also agree that the second and third one is bloated. Maybe the fourth one is forgettable. I haven't even seen that one. But
you shouldn't.
It's but people terrible. still uh, Yeah, I have a feeling. But people still say that, but the first one is really good. The first one is always known as the good one. And exactly. You're basically saying that you're coming at it from the point of view of where I come at, like, Transformers, and saying, like, it was never good to begin with.
I'm in that same boat with you in terms of the Transformers movies, too. But, like, I am of that with this one. I was like, well, they were never good to begin with. But I think that, like, the elements that I ultimately do appreciate mostly, I think, come to the sequels mainly because if I can't make heads or tails of which movie is which, at least I feel like some of the weirder, stranger elements came from those movies, and those feel like they came from Gore Verbinski. Like, those elements feel like they're uniquely his. And speaking of On Stranger Tides, and I haven't seen the latest one, but I will say that Verbinski's three movies are visually appealing. Like, they're very visually dynamic movies, and I feel like in the fourth one, and at least from the trailers I've seen of this newest one, are super
They don't have flat. much of a vision. They're movies put together by committee with a bunch of suits and all that stuff. Yeah, it definitely has that feeling. And yeah, Verbinski is definitely one of those directors who, even if he makes like a mediocre or even a bad movie, he adds something unique and kind of absurdist in a way. Like, his movies have like some weird stuff in them, even the things that, like, as boring and kind of uneven as and forgettable, honestly, as The Lone Ranger was, it had some like really weird stuff in it. Like, there's this one part where Tonto like threatens to rape one of the bad guys with like a duck's leg or something. Like, it's like he adds some like really weird, interesting stuff into like whatever movie he's making, and the Pirates movies kind of have that too. But yeah, so I do so you're basically saying that let's stick to Curse of the Black Pearl for now.
Sure.
And so why do you think, because we kind of, without even getting into it, anyone who's listening to the podcast or anybody who has seen the second and third one, the general consensus seems to be that the second and third one are too bloated. They put too much weight on Jack Sparrow as a character. Like, he works better as a side character, which is why I kind of could tolerate and kind of like the fifth one, because he's relegated to like being a side character again. And, you know, and they're overlong. They're too just all over the place and just headache inducing and all that stuff. But why do you think specifically Curse of the Black Pearl like is a non-starter to begin with?
I think it's a non-starter because I was rewatching it and I'm like, man, I remember, like, other than the things that I joked about that I was looking forward to in the sequels that were not in this movie, but I was like, man, I remember like pretty much every plot beat of this movie, like, weirdly enough. And I realized, because there's really maybe about five plot beats and the rest is just like nonstop, incessant swashbuckling that just goes on and on and on forever. Mm-hmm. And it just gets so deafening and boring. Like Verbinski is a very versatile director with the camera, but like I feel like, and the reason I really don't like this movie, especially this first one, which most people love, and I think people like it because it is palatable, because there's not much that happens and the plot is very straightforward in this one, I think people are able to cling on to it. And I also think there's this there's a couple things. Number one, at the time, you know, this was seen as kind of a joke before, like when it was in production. They were like, oh my God, Disney is going to make a movie off a theme park ride. Like they laughed in its face.
And behind the scenes, the producers were like losing their shit because they thought Johnny Depp had lost his mind with his performance and all that. So there was a lot of like turmoil going on.
Exactly. It was like in the trades. It was like a big thing. And then the movie came out and it sort of pulled, like, I guess the most recent like comparison I could think of would be something like World War Z, where it was like its production was so under like scrutiny and under a microscope. And then the movie came out and people were just kind of like met with this like, well, that wasn't terrible. Like, sort of like, well,
yeah, the,
like,
it's the low expectations. Like,
sure. And I think I think the movie, number one, this feels less like a Gore Verbinski movie to me and more like a Jerry Bruckheimer production, which is why I don't like it, because I don't like most Jerry Bruckheimer movies that aren't rated R. And even then, it's questionable. And secondly, it puts way too much stock in the Orlando Bloom character, Will Turner, who's just the most boring block of wood. Like, I posted
Bloom and Keira Knightley both are just holes of charisma.
Sure. I will say their relationship is, she's quite good in this first movie. Like, she was actually the one thing that I kind of took away this time around. I was like, oh, she's kind of an interesting character, and she's got the spunk, and she's like, you know, kind of fierce. And I liked that. And out of all the performances, including Johnny Depp, it was the one out of this movie that I was like, oh, I like her in this movie. But when you put their relationship together, oh, I couldn't care less. Like, he drags her down, and they just...
he's really dull. Like, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Keira Knightley's performance, but I do agree that it's slightly better. It has a little bit than Orlando Bloom. It has a little bit more spunk.
Mm-hmm.
Orlando Bloom is a guy who just like really fit Legolas because he was supposed to be this like emotionless elf character, but then anything else where they just like struggled so much to turn him into a major star, it just didn't hold because he just really doesn't have that much of a presence. And the fifth movie, the one thing that I kind of admired was first of all, they straight up copy paste those characters into the fifth movie.
Right, the new characters are basically...
Like, they're the exact same characters. I mean, the guy is like Orlando Bloom's character's son anyway. And the girl is exactly like that kind of plucky, like, this is the 17th century patriarchy, but I'm still going to act like, you know, I'm going to be like that rebellious girl who's like struggling to get respect. And it's the same exact kind of character, but at least the actors they chose, maybe because they're like relative unknowns, like they put a lot of effort into it, mm-hmm. even though they probably knew that this is just, you know, a cash grab fifth pirate sequel that no one's really going to give a shit about. But at least they have those two kids had some like natural presence and charisma that I thought is just sorely lacking as far as like you said, like as far as the relationship goes, because Keira Knightley is more tolerable when she's in, for example, like there's a sequence where Jack Sparrow and her character get stuck on the island.
It's my favorite scene in the
movie.
That's
like, that's fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything to do with the relationship. And the thing about it that bugs me so much is how much of the running time Gore Verbinski just like devotes to that, and it feels so flat to me.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really work, and mainly because it just doesn't. There's not a lot of work done in that there's not a lot of work done to make that relationship work to begin with, I guess, because it's just like you're introduced the prologue of the movie, you're introduced to how they meet as kids. That Will Turner floats off the Black Pearl as another ship, or the other ship is destroyed. But then it fast forwards like 13 years later, and then it's just like their chemistry together is like a non-starter from that point. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't, like, the work is like, oh, okay, so they've known each other, but that spark that would like make that them feel that passionately about each other is just not.
Yeah, it's not only the performances. They're that relationship is very underwritten too.
Right.
It's very kind of on the surface.
It's there because reasons. That's
yeah.
why. It's
yeah,
it's,
exactly.
Yeah, that's, and I just, yeah, it's,
oh, this just doesn't have a very strong script. I mean, they must have been like, after this success of the movie, and then Johnny Depp's performance and that character became like a household name, and they must have been like, really, that's why I think they put so much stock into Johnny Depp and Jack Sparrow in the second and third movies. I don't know about the fourth one. It was because I feel like they kind of knew that he was the saving grace of that movie, because if you just take him out of it, it's just like a really boring, dull, like, it's like, it's Cutthroat Island. If you just take him out of it, it's straight up Cutthroat Island.
Yes, it
is. With some magic, like with supernatural elements. That's pretty much all it is, really.
Right. And I wondered too, like, watching it this time, because I had to pretend I was watching it in 2003 and be like, okay, if we didn't have that, you know, decade or more of baggage with him basically replicating the Jack Sparrow role in just about everything he's done since, I'm like, is this performance going to bug me? And it didn't for the most part. Like you think about that baggage and then it kind of kicks in and you're like, oh yeah, this is what you've been doing for 14 years. But then at the same time, I could, like, it's easy for him to steal this movie. Like, I'm looking at it and it's like, oh, like in this time, in this moment, that was a fresh, like, kind of unpredictable spin in an otherwise very predictable rote movie. And so, like, I could see why, like, people, like, grew attached to that character, because he does stand out. He stands out amongst the wallpaper, essentially. And so, but yeah, they do put too much stock in that character. And the fourth one is just him, because Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom are cut from it. And it just doesn't, like, it gets so tired, and it gets tired from, like, the start, essentially. And
you're just exhausted within the first couple of minutes.
Exactly. I'm like, oh, yep, this is the thing.
And the shtick gets old too after a while. I mean, a little of him, I can see the appeal. I can see why people liked it. I can see, like, I kind of also applaud, like, Depp's bravery and how he approached that performance, whether or not he was trolling because he thought the movie was going to be shit anyway, or whether or not he was genuinely trying to make, like, some choices that could be entertaining and fun for the audience. Either way, it worked. And but at the same time, it's like, this is the kind of cartoonish character that you put in a big budget blockbuster, like action adventure epic, that the less you have of him as a side character, the better off you will be. But then the flip side of that is that your leads and your main romantic plot, your main action plot that revolves around these characters, like the Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley character, should be interesting. Those should be well written as well. You can't just, like, put all your weight on what's supposed to be a side character, which is kind of what happens in Pirates of the Curse of the Black Pearl. It's like it kind of suffers from an identity crisis. It doesn't know if it wants to be, like, a cartoonish pirate comedy with supernatural elements, or like an epic adventure, like swashbuckling love story in the old, like, Errol Flynn type of thing. You know what I mean? Like, it can't, I guess, like, for our audience who are nanogenarians, like, in their 90s, I should say, like, it can't decide if it wants to be an Errol Flynn picture or a Bob Hope picture.
Sure. And I'm okay with the genre bending.
Current, like, references, very modern references.
Yeah, totally. Way to go. Way to go. Sick reference, bro. Everyone knows your references are out of control.
That Flynn Gish is hot.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't mind the genre bending necessarily. Like, I don't mind that it wants to be both those things if it could pull it off. Like, I have no problem with that. Yeah. And I just think that, again, I think it's a pretty dull movie. And I think people have fonder memories of this movie than they may think, because of the freshness of Depp's performance and the fact that there hadn't really been, like, a pirate epic or a pirate movie in years. So for, like, a new generation, it was sort of a fresh genre. And then I think for, like, you know, critics at the time and an older audience at the time, I mean, I guess, I don't know how you define older, but, like, just the fact that the movie was, like, it didn't suck. It didn't suck the way that, like, it, like, the knives were out for this movie, and the fact that it was, like, cohesive and comprehensible at all, people were surprised by it, and I think it got a huge pass.
Yeah. And then how shitty, like, the Haunted Mansion turned out to be, or the Country Bears. It also kind of solidified that, like, yeah, this was a shitty idea, and they actually, like, the fact that they pulled off, like, a halfway decent movie out of it was kind of a miracle when you compare it to those movies.
It was overhyped, but the one thing the movie does well is it does introduce, like, it does drop you into this world, and it does feel like a world, like a cinematically built thing. And so, like, I could see where, you know, whereas, like, something like the Haunted Mansion of the Country Bears just wouldn't work the way that, because this movie introduces it, you know, of course, a very convoluted in later movies, but, like, it introduces this, like, really weirdly dense mythology to all of them. I mean, that starts with this movie, but so I could see where
you can kind of follow it in this movie. It really goes overboard with the second and third one.
I don't know what happened. Like, those movies are so indulgent, and again, there's some weird interesting stuff, and I think that was mostly courtesy of Gore Verbinski. And I think Gore Verbinski with this movie, like, while it is visually appealing and the production design is really good, and Hans Zimmer's score does get tiresome, but it is a good score ultimately. But I think this movie just had to function. It just had to function to not be a gigantic, it had to function to not be Waterworld for Disney, essentially. And so I feel like the Bruckheimer tendency, like the machine of the Bruckheimer productions was in place, and Verbinski was just like the director to steer the ship. And honestly, like, I can't blame him, because at this point he had only made Mouse Hunt and The Ring, which The Ring was a pretty big cultural phenomenon. Oh, he did make The Mexican. That's right. Okay, mm-hmm. So he made three movies, but none to this scale.
Which is another, like, kind of fascinating piece of mediocrity.
Yeah, like, The Mexicans.
That movie wasn't good either, but it had his, like, unique...
It did.
Some of his unique touches.
Must be just like the forgotten movie, because I totally forgot he made that movie. Oh, yeah. But I feel like the reason I wanted to bring Jerry Bruckheimer up so much, and because I feel like somehow in passing, somehow in on the Disney lot somewhere, that Gore Verbinski and Nicolas Cage were sitting there having lunch together after working on Pirates, after working on National Treasure for Nicolas Cage. And they just had to vent. Get out their frustrations. And they're just like, hey, let's make a movie together. Let's make a weird, fucking, ballsy, strange character piece together. And that movie became The Leatherman.
Let's make an indie... Let's make a weird, fucked up indie movie with a big studio budget.
Exactly. Or relatively big.
Which will
big.
Never happen now.
There's
no way that movie would be made right now.
You say that, but I got to squeeze in a little bit just before we swing into The Weatherman. You could say the same thing for Cure for Wellness. That's a very strange, bizarre...
Oh, I still haven't seen it, so... Yeah.
Mid-budget movie. Oh, man, I really like that movie.
I'm surprised
a lot.
That was pulled off as well.
Oh, it tanked so hard too. It was face planted.
The fact that it was even made in this climate.
Oh
was
my
kind
god!
Of a big deal.
You should see it. Just I think you would. If you don't like it, I think you would at least appreciate that. Like, there's
it
some,
looks like one of those movies. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some weird ass touches that I liked, but ultimately I found it to be like a very like kind of sly satire on studio filmmaking, which, you know, what we should talk about that off mic when you get a chance to see the movie. But The Weatherman, like, I realized why I love Cure for Wellness so much by rewatching The Weatherman, like, because there's just it's just so...
Oh, that makes me curious about it even more. So let's get into it. Why did you pick The Weatherman as your underrated?
Tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce. Man, I'd like to put my face in there. Right in there, tartar sauce. My hips are cold. Tartar sauce, that's when you know it's cold. I like eating pussy. Tartar sauce. A lot of guys don't. Well, maybe they do. Maybe that's just black guys. Tartar sauce. What happened to the guy who was trying to go around the world in a balloon? Did he make it? I should put some espionage or stolen plutonium in my novel, Tartar Sauce. Spice it up. Neil Young. Fuck, it's cold. Neil Young. What? Why am I thinking about Neil Young? Neil Diamond. Neil. There's not a lot of famous Neils. Is this Wednesday? I wish I had two dicks.
Because I just think this movie... First of all, I won't bury my lead. I love this movie. Like, I wholeheartedly loved it, and I loved it when I saw it in 2005. And I still love this movie. And I just feel like it's a movie... And it's a strange point in Nicolas Cage's career. I mean, not necessarily strange.
Right before the tax problems, and where he's just like doing one straight to video movie after the other.
Exactly.
And
well, because he was doing a good job of doing the like one for me, one for them movie, where like he would do the National Treasure,
and then do Weatherman,
and Lord of War, which came out around the same time. Andrew Niccol, which like I liked that movie quite a bit.
Oh yeah, me too.
There was one other title and I'm blanking on it, but The Weatherman was in that period. And I feel like this movie, number one, nobody but Nicolas Cage could have played Dave Spritz. There's no way anybody else could have pulled it off, because I think the movie is so almost like a perfect analogy for Cage's career, or how people perceive Nicolas Cage, because like especially like the scenes where shit gets thrown at him, where people are just throwing fast food and throwing Frosties at him, and I think because like Nick Cage has this sort of aura around him that there people just want to straight punch him in the face. Like, he's got one of those faces that people are just like, I just want to lay one of them on. Like that conversation where the husband and wife are watching the TV and she's
I think
he's
his
handsome.
Face.
Yeah, like I think he's handsome. And she's just like, he's an asshole. and I think that, like, that, like, people think that about Nichols. Like, yeah. He's got that polarizing feel to him.
I can
him.
See that, but at the same time, he is fascinating and likable. And just like the... Yeah. He's likable, maybe not likable, but relatable in a way. At least like the character in the movie is just like so infinitely relatable, as much of a dick and as much of a just a child. Like, he acts like such a child in so many places. And you just like kind of roll your eyes and cover your face just because it's so awkward and weird. But like, you can't turn away because you relate to everything that he's kind of going through.
Yeah.
And I'll just come right out and say it. This was my favorite film of 2005. It was one of my top 10 films of last decade. I really love this movie. I think it is grossly underrated in terms of, you know, at least in terms of a studio picture that could really brutally deal with like the existential crisis of pretty much every adult goes through in life. It's an incredibly in your face movie. It is a brutal movie. It is just kind of uncomfortable and awkward at times, but it's like an immensely human film, and it's an immensely relatable film. It just basically deals with what it's like to be an adult. And this is a film that I just love returning, coming back to every couple of years. And with the life experiences that I gather over whatever the last time I watched it, like I get something completely different out of it, because it does really speak to all the kind of the, you know, like the, it's just the hectic, confusing existential anxiety of being an adult, you know, that like that kind of doubt you have constantly, the constant doubt that you have in yourself about like what you can achieve and where are you in life, what's my purpose in life, what am I doing, and then just all the time feeling like, you know, I'm a loser, but people haven't like really figured that out yet, and like just that kind of like insecurity that goes on while you're also dealing with like all this various crap that kind of like the adult life throws at you. Like, this is a film that like deals with this in a brutally honest, but like incredibly empathetic way.
Totally. Like, you know, what does he constantly say? He's like, I'm going to fix this, or I'm going to get there. And, you know, there's that sad realization that just like, you really never do. Like, you just do the best you can, but you never really get to that point. And yeah, I think it's
the key of the movie is like, by the way, this is one of the best screenplays in my opinion, that's written over the last, during the last decade.
And it's crazy that his Stephen
Conrad.
Yeah. And it's crazy that
it's an amazing script.
It is. It's an incredible script, but I also have to, like, you know, you have to contribute. I'm curious. I'm just so curious if his scripts for Pursuit of Happiness and Secret Life of Walter Mitty were good and they were just kind of sentimentalized in the direction. Because if that's the case, then obviously, like, him and Gore Verbinski were just on the same wavelength in terms of this movie. Like, they knew exactly what kind of...
Yeah, it definitely
of...
looks like they were on the same page. I mean, those other two are a little bit more, like, different, uplifting kind of stories anyway. But I'm sure he added his own brand of just, like... Yeah, he does this really well in a way that he's almost like a more accessible mix of like Todd Solondz and like Charlie Kaufman, like just deals with like these people who are like complete messes. I think the one movie he directed is called The Promotion with John C. Reilly.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Sean William Scott, and it has that same kind of like the awkwardness of life and how like hard it is to like relate to people, and he always creates in his movies, at least the ones that were adapted, like kind of straight from his, that where, you know, the director, he was on the same page with the director. He has this almost like approach that lifts the veneer of like polite society and just shows you that, like, you know, like there's this thing in like The Weatherman where wherever he goes, like people who serve him, like they obviously don't give a shit about him. Mm-hmm. Like people are just like openly rude. people are just annoying and just like just shows like almost like if you took out that like kind of phony thing that people have in like modern society, like people don't, you know, it's just like it almost shows that people don't really give a shit about that. Like, everybody's going through their own like stressful thing, and it kind of like captures that really well. Like even like small moments, like you know, he goes to just get coffee, and the guy doesn't even care about that. You know, the coffee costs a little bit extra with the tax, and he can't get the paper for his dad and all that stuff. Like it's just that I find that stuff to be brilliant.
Yeah, no, I think it's incredibly brilliant. I love the way that it feels like the and you get a lot of like voiceover and internal monologuing, but I think the thing that Verbinski and Conrad do really well is like almost everything that the Dave Spritz character says, it feels like his internal monologue is going outwards. Like almost everything he's thinking, he's saying, but it's not in like a hacky on the nose screenplay way. It's just like he's like got this frustration that just doesn't know what to say. He doesn't even know how to insult people properly. Like when he insults his ex-wife's fiance, it's just the funniest thing. Yeah,
well, what he does dildo to the guy but after that too.
I was gonna bring that up.
Just like perfectly nice, and he comes down, and his Nicolas Cage's character like goes through this like kind of really bad situation with his son,
and he slaps him with the glove.
He slaps him with the fucking glove.
That's so
good.
And then
his reaction there, and then the way that he cuts back to like him and his dad, and the one of the overall goals, like the one of the driving forces for the character, is for him to, you know, his father is Michael Caine. He's a big Pulitzer Prize winning author, he's going to die, and he's just, Nicolas Cage is basically known as this like goofy weatherman who just like lost his family because he was like an insecure dick who didn't know how to like handle things. And all he wants is for his father to like feel proud of him, of his achievements before he dies, like with a happy family. And like his voiceover even says that, yes, he was successful and he was busy all the time, but he was also a good father. He was like the perfect package. But then at the same time, the film kind of like really subtly and in an incredibly insightful way, like goes into like what does success entail? What does it mean? What does making it quote unquote mean really? And there are some like really interesting clues around the film, the visual clues that show that maybe his father, like his father's idea of success might not have anything to do with how he's constantly talking about like, oh, I'm going to be like this millionaire weatherman for network television in New York, and I'm going to get all my family to come with me. And I feel like in a way it's almost like his father is like, yeah, I mean, that kind of comes clear in this beautiful scene at near the end where they talk in the car. And I think, you know, the one I'm talking about.
Oh, beautiful. Where like a rock is playing.
The Bob Seger scene. And that all comes out to in the open during that scene about like what he really thinks of life and what he really thinks achievement means. But there are all these like wonderful clues here and there that like for example, at the beginning where you first meet his father, Nicolas Cage is at his father's house, and he's talking about like what a huge success his father was and how like he's yearning to like gain his respect and all that stuff. And then you see that his father is using his Pulitzer Prize as a paperweight.
Right.
So that's kind of like a pretty cool visual cue to like kind of telegraph the fact that, yeah, he didn't put that much like of mental real estate into his big achievements anyway. He probably just cared about his family and tried to do the best he could. And that's kind of like what he says at the end. It's just like, I'm just a normal guy who like practiced writing and I just got better at it. That's all I did. Like there's there's nothing really beyond like trying to do the best while you're navigating life in a way. And that's what it kind of comes down to. And as kind of uncomfortable and just brutally honest as it is at times, in a way it's almost like it's a film that has a pretty zen outlook, which is really weird when you're dealing with like such a kind of really in your face, like R-rated character study.
Right. I mean, there is like a there are sequences that have like not just because they're dream sequences, but there is like a dream like quality to the movie, like amongst all the like anxieties, amongst the like the ticks of the clocks against Hans Zimmer's score, which is really good and really, really subtle in this movie. Like
it's a great, great minimalistic score, and I just like, yeah, I love those touches in the score, which is like the seconds going, and it's just like time is just like constantly running out, and it just like adds to the anxiety of the character in a really subtle way. It just sounds like one of those scores that he just did it on his like computer, like over a weekend or something, but it fits so well. Like it fits the character so well in the film.
And I forgot, like, you know, when he buckles down and like he's still great even in his like overly bombastic scores, but it's like it's so nice to be like, oh yeah, you could actually do like low-key like drama type scores too. Mm-hmm. So that's really nice. I'm glad you brought up the scene like towards the end of the movie with him and his dad, because I mean, that is like the pivotal moment, not just because, like, you know, he's made peace with what is going to happen, but through that Bob Seger song, you know, he pulls up and starts playing it because he had mentioned at his father's funeral, like, I think of the song Like a Rock. And then, of course, the power goes out because everything shitty happens to him. Mm-hmm. You know, his father's like, I don't get it. And then Nicolas Cage explains to him like why that reminds him of his dad, and like in a way they, you know, come to the terms of like what success means for either of them, or what like what they got out of life, what it means for either of them. Like they didn't have an understanding, but like instead of just continuing to not understand each other, like through that song they just made that connection to finally like hear one another. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's a great scene.
It's such a beautiful and honest scene, and I love the way that Steve Conrad just like writes these like little bits of dialogue that just like gets so much across. Like the I just love that line of like, you know, easy doesn't enter into grown-up life. That's basically the whole anchor of the movie in that one line right there, where his father tells him that. Mm-hmm. And also like when his father, like at the very end is saying like, in this life, you have to chuck some shit, like some things are not going to work out, you know, not everybody's like, and it's kind of his way of saying that I'm not this, like, I'm human just like you. I'm not this like otherworldly genius that you have to like strive to like, catch up to. And I just love how Conrad's dialogue just captures these kind of very relatable emotions.
I agree. And it's also like just brutally hilarious throughout the movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
you know, it's melancholic, of course, and it's existential, but it's also just one of the funniest movies I've seen. Like just the dialogue, like especially the scene that gets to me is like, whether it's a flashback,
the tartar sauce,
yes, the inner monologue he has is just so fantastic. And I haven't,
because he captures like how random like your inner monologue works, especially when you're just like going out to do some like random thing. And I just love how it's like it starts with like him going like tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce, and it's just like he's constantly trying to, and then tartar sauce like enters in his mind from time to time, but it gets like less and less. Yeah. And in the meantime he's talking about like Neil Young. Yeah. I wonder, there aren't a lot of famous Neils.
Yeah.
And then there's this like woman in front of him. He's just like, I'd like to bury my face in her ass. But the way that it's edited is brilliant, because he doesn't take even a second of space in between those thoughts. It's still just like this random train of thought, just like nonstop.
Yeah.
And then like it has this like the cutting in this film, the editing, comedy editing is just so funny. Like the way that we mentioned, like after that moment of like he straight up slaps his ex-wife's boyfriend with his glove, and then it hard cuts to him and his dad in the cab just being silent, and then the voiceover just saying like, if you don't want your dad to think you're a complete fucking asshole, maybe don't like slap someone with
unless you're being noble or something. Yeah.
And he's like, I'm not.
Yeah, I'm not.
And then, yeah, the writing, especially the voiceover writing, and it's weird, because between this and Adaptation, which is another my two favorite Nicolas Cage performances ever, are scripts that are in like this rare category of use of voiceover of not just like storytelling, you know, with the past tense kind of thing, but like use of voiceover to depict inner monologue as it happens inside the character. That's just brilliant. Like between adaptation and this, they really capture like what it's like to just like have an inner monologue. That's just like, that's kind of confusing and convoluted, and you can't really like focus on exactly what you want to say. And yeah, I just love it's the voiceover in this film is great.
Yeah, it's used to a great effect. And I also have to give like some shout out too, like to some of the other performances in this movie, like other than Nick Cage and Michael Caine, because everyone's pretty strong across the board. Like Hope Davis is really, really good in the movie too.
My MVP, one of my MVPs, especially that doesn't really get mentioned a lot, is Gil Bellows. Is that his name? From Ally McBeal, the guy who plays the kind of pedophile who goes out and kind of like starts seducing his son.
Yes, I was wondering where I saw him before, and now that you said that.
He was famous from like Ally McBeal. He was in The Shawshank Redemption and all that.
He's really good, and that's
he's really good in this. In the way that, because he doesn't come across as like right off the bat, you totally understand. Like you feel uncomfortable as soon as he comes into the picture, because you know what his end goal is. You totally understand his character. You know exactly what's going on. But the way that he approaches it and the way that he's written is just like, I just love that, how like he just keeps cursing just to like relate to the kids, for example, like these pathetic moves like that. But he doesn't come across as like immediately just creepy and off-putting. Like he just comes across like gradually like a cool dude who just like likes hanging out with kids, and you know where it's going, but then at the same time you understand why this kid is like, especially with kind of a absentee father or a father who's just like really awkward and doesn't even know how to parent, who's out of the picture. It's like you could see that why he would become friends with this guy. And then I also like really appreciate that subplot doesn't end with us seeing, you know, that awkward moment of like where the guy like makes a move on the kid.
Yeah, we just hear
and
it
like all that. We just hear about like what happened, because it's a good move, because you really don't need to actually see that scene. You know it's coming anyway.
Yeah,
and the way that subplot is resolved is brilliant. Not in the way that like it story wise it does end in a predictable way, as like this kind of chance for him to like kind of redeem himself and kind of quote unquote become a man by kind of like going after the guy. But the way that it's edited is hilarious, because like you hear while he's on his way, he keeps thinking about like why he's constantly being hit with fast food, and he's like, clowns get hit with fast food. And then he just like, the voiceover stops and he does like, there's like really awkward fight scene, and then once that's over, the voiceover just continues exactly where he left off.
it's so good, and it's so, like I said, it's so strange, and it's so just like defies what we know about. And the other movie I thought about a lot while watching this movie, and I know it's definitely an overrated movie for you. It's a movie I like, but I thought of American Beauty a lot watching this movie.
Yeah, like, I can see that.
But like in terms of like the voiceover, but like I feel like this movie just does it all, just does it too, in like a much more subtle and much more like realistic and humane way. And I know that movies like it's brought up to like these
the difference is that The Weatherman has this like really fresh lack of pretension.
Yes.
Like it's not desperate to have you like him, have you like the character, or have you like the movie even, because it kind of shows like, yeah, people are fucked up, they're weird, and we're just trying to like make it. And I love like going back to the writing again, I just love the metaphors of like, you know, his job as a weatherman, he's trying to understand how this works, and so he's just like constantly trying to talk to the guy who's in charge of like all the scientific stuff, and he's like, I'm trying to understand it, why is this happening? And the guy is just like, it's wind, man, it just blows all over the place, how the fuck should I know? Like, it just it gets to that point, and it's like this really funny but completely appropriate metaphor for life. And then he actually even like uses it as a metaphor later on. And I just love all these like touches that just you know, like as far as I do script coaching and I do script coverages. And the thing that I, one of the things that I really admire in an extremely well-written screenplay is be able to like use almost every plot element to create a cohesive theme. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those scripts that does it, like is a master at doing that.
And it could have been so wrong-headed, watching this movie again,
it could have been so pretentious, it could have been so like obvious,
yeah, so on the nose, and like this movie's in your face but it isn't obvious,
like,
or
like one of those indie movies that say like it's a metaphor for life, you know, like those kinds of movies, which is definitely those,
right,
that
but,
kind of
but
movie.
it feels earned yeah, because exactly. you're Verbinski and Conrad are putting these characters through some shit, like they're putting them through real life, like tough shit to deal with. Like a character is like, okay, he's divorced and his dad is dying and all this stuff. And it's like his youngest daughter's smoking and his son is having other issues, you know, it's
dealing
like
with being bullied and being called camel toe, which that really ends in a hilariously unpredictable way as well.
Yes.
What the girl considers camel toe to be and all that stuff, and he's just like, and that also goes towards like again, like that's why I love the script so much, because everything in it can be traced back to the theme of like nothing is in life is certain, it's the wind that just blows all over the place, because he thinks his daughter's going through some like heavy shit because of the way that she's being bullied at school, and then it turns out that maybe she's doing just fine.
Yeah. It's that same thing with like the scene with him and Michael Caine towards the end of the movie. It's just like, just have the conversation. Just talk with one another and break that that barrier of assumption down. So it's it's a movie. It's great. I do love this movie. I hadn't seen it in years. Like it had been a long time since I'd seen it, and I watched it last night, rented it on VOD, and was just like, damn it, this movie's still fucking great.
Oh yeah,
and
it has dated extremely well.
It
and
really
also,
has, and I feel like it's even better than it was when I saw it. In
yeah, it was a little bit ahead of its time, like with the kind of postmodern, more kind of ironically detached yet kind of still really closely connected to existentialism and all that stuff that we're like dealing with these days. It really fits into that mold. What really sets it apart is the fact that it's a studio film, not a like small budget indie or something like that.
This was put out by Paramount, which is crazy to me. And it was made for like, I think it only made like 20 million. I want to say it was budgeted around then, but it could have been more. I have no idea.
This is a movie that doesn't have like, it's a straight up character piece, doesn't have much of a plot. It is like the character itself is not like, he's a dick. He is completely like out of his element most of the time. He is what makes him so fascinating and what makes you kind of keep watching him, because he's always relatable.
Yeah.
Even when he's just acting like a total piece of shit child, like the glove slapping, or this moment where he's practicing his archery, which again goes back to like the themes of the film. It's like archery like gives you control over something, mm-hmm. that at least like you feel like you have control over something. And I think that's what it gives to that character. That's such a like interesting little element that he adds in there. As far as the screenwriting goes, it's just like every single choice that Stevie Conrad made is just like, it fits perfectly. And there's this one moment where he straight up turns the arrow to his wife's boyfriend. And it's just like, there's just like really, like he does some like really weird, stupid shit. But at the same time, every single thing that he does, you can totally relate to it, because his motivation is always like, I'm doing this for my family. I want to get my family back.
Yeah.
Like his motivation is always like trying to gain some semblance of respect from people, trying to figure out his place in life. It's not just that he's an asshole just for the sake of being an asshole. It's that he is just lost and he is trying everything. And because of that, he's also letting his anxieties and frustrations like bubble up to the surface. And he's making these like really wildly stupid decisions. And and it's also a combination of that and a combination of just like straight up regular bad luck that everybody has to deal with day in and day out. And then the movie does a really good job of like kind of balancing those things.
I agree, and this is my favorite kind of Nicolas Cage performance. Like,
oh yeah,
how he balances that, because, like, you know, I love Face Off, Nick Cage. You know, I love, like, when Cage goes, like,
yeah, the insane
bug-eyed Nicolas Cage. Yeah. You know, we all, well, maybe not we all, but, like, I certainly love that. But, like, the best Nicolas Cage performances are the ones where, I mean, he's subdued, but you feel that Cage could burst out in any second, mm-hmm. but he doesn't. And those mm-hmm. are the, those are, to me, are the best Nicolas Cage performances, because he's got an intensity and he's got a focus, but he's keeping it grounded and he's keeping it down to earth. And
yeah, and that might be why I can't decide whether or not this or Adaptation is my favorite Nicolas Cage performance, because they're kind of in that same the same kind of category of, like, there, like you said, there's, like, something that's always bubbling underneath, mm-hmm. but he just, like, yeah, he can be incredibly subtle.
He can
when he wants to. And, like, if you think about it, like, his performance is, like, fairly calm and grounded. If you take out, like, his frustrations, his crazy comes out through the voiceover. But if you take out the voiceover, which is another thing that shows you that, like, another thing that I really love about the film is that it shows you, like, how people are able to, like, put up a mask in society when, like, all this, like, crazy shit is going through their minds. There are a lot of scenes like that where it's just like everything just looks, he's just waiting at the DMV, like nothing else is going on, and then he's thinking about, like, all these, like, really depressing, anxiety ridden things about his life. And, you know, so his performance, like, if you take out the voiceover, which really gives the character, like, it's his anxiety, this is a pretty grounded and pretty, like, kind of balanced performance.
It is. It's great. And I'm with you. It's one of my, it may not be my favorite, but it's, like, it's top three, probably, Nicolas Cage performances. It's up there.
It's one of his most accomplished, I think, as far as, you know, just dramatic acting, his dramatic acting is concerned. I agree.
And it's my favorite, probably my favorite Gore Verbinski movie. I really like Rango also. I guess I had to, like, shout out to other movies that he's made that I really like.
Oh, this is one of my favorite Michael Caine performances as well. I think he's brilliant.
He's so good in this movie.
So deadpan, but, like, you just understand that character through and through. Yeah. Definitely.
No, it's good.
But yeah, Rango, definitely Rango. I love Rango.
Yeah, I do too. I think it even won the Oscar that year. For best animated feature, so deserved. Lone Ranger, you pretty much said it. Like, that movie's a mess, but there are some moments. There are some interesting moments in that movie that clearly, like, this director put in it. I actually think the third act of that movie is kind of fun in terms of, like, the set piece that it is.
Yeah.
There's
some stuff. Lone Ranger is almost like, there's some stuff in Lone Ranger when I'm just like, man, if Buster Keaton had this technology down, this is kind of like what he would make.
Yeah, where, like, the ladders are kind of, like, going from train to train.
So I'm thinking, like, they did right by that kind of, like, slapstick, because the intellectual property itself is also, like, really old kind of Western, serialized kind of cheesy thing anyway. So they kind of, like, captured that pretty well. But again, like, I think kind of the same with Pirates is that the studios, and also maybe Verbinski's, like, ideal of, like, turning that material into, like, a big epic, like, mm-hmm. big budget, huge epic, they just kind of, like, ruined the simplicity of the cheesiness, the inherent cheesiness of the premise. And that's why I think Lone Ranger fails as a movie, even though it has some, like, pretty spectacular
moments,
set pieces in it.
Yeah, it's got some moments, but yeah, that movie just doesn't really work. And then Cure for Wellness, I think you can buy it on VOD right now, and probably by the time this episode drops, it'll be on Blu-ray. And I recommend it, you know, like, it was, like, the most critically well-received movie, and it tanked the box office, but I haven't really stopped thinking about it since I've seen it, so
yeah, I definitely need to check that one out. And I think he's a pretty decent horror director as well.
Yeah, The Ring's a solid movie.
If the original Ring didn't exist, I would think the Ring remake is a solid translation. It's just, like, it sticks so close to the original, and the kind of practical effect heavy, in-camera effect heavy approach of the original is just so inherently creepy that it's hard to top that with a big studio film with more like impressive effects and more impressive glitzy cinematography and all that. Like the rawness and the muckiness of that, the Japanese version is just what makes it so creepy. And
but he does a good job with it.
It does a good job. Like if you, especially when you consider it to like the endless array of like J horror remakes around that time.
Oh, I mean the American Ring. Yeah, I was about to say the American Ring is like head and shoulders above most remakes.
Not even like, but
it's not even close. I hate that people like mix it and the Grudge up, like especially like the American remakes. I was like, no, the Grudge sucks.
I think the original of the Grudge is kind of crappy anyway. That franchise was never like great to begin with, but like yeah, like Dark Water and The Eye, the Tale of Two Sisters was remade as something else. I forgot the name, but that's there's so many of those that's. Compared to those, it's head and shoulders. Yeah, it's a fucking masterpiece. But I'm totally appreciative of The Ring. The same with the Mexican is he's one of his like even though it's like a kind of mediocre Brad Pitt. Who's the female? Julia Roberts. It has some like really offbeat touches in there. Like I don't really remember that movie that well because I had no desire to like revisit it. Mouse Hunt is blessed.
I was gonna Mouse say Hunt, Mouse yeah, Hunt
is a live action cartoon and it's kind of fun.
It is,
it's
I believe.
Just, it's just
I,
too in your face and too just manic to like really appreciate in a way.
If I remember correctly, I believe our fellow playlister and friend of the show and former co-host Eric McClanahan was gonna pick Mouse Hunt as an underrated at some point.
Oh yeah, he really likes the movie.
Yeah, and we never made it to it, but
maybe in the future.
Yeah, maybe in the future. Brief shout out for.
Yeah, so the guy is like even his misses, there's something fascinating there, and I really appreciate the way that he takes chances on different genres and different styles, mm-hmm. and he's never like really, but then at the same time you can pinpoint. There's stuff that you can pinpoint between Pirates of the Caribbean and The Weatherman, especially as far as like eccentric performances or just like these really like the Pirates of the Caribbean has like these really kind of semi absurdist, almost like ironic touches in it, like self-aware almost. And there's stuff, there's stylistic stuff, there's thematic stuff that kind of like you can tell his style, even though he just does like very vastly different things.
Yeah.
And then the second and third Pirates of the Caribbean movies, I think he got kind of stuck in the just bloated mythology that they tried to come across with basically that centered around basically what was supposed to be like a comedy relief side character.
Right.
And that was a giant misstep. But even those movies, like as far as I remember, because like I just checked out of those. Like I think I just saw like the last half of the third one because I was so uninterested in the second one. But it also has like some weird shit in it. You know, like just that's kind of entertaining. It's not used in the service of a good or even like halfway comprehensible movie, but there's stuff like that, and his collaborations with Johnny Depp, I feel like the reason why Rango worked so well, which I think that was like one of my favorite films the year it came out. I still love that movie. I love how crazy and weird it is as a big budget animated movie for kids. Like that's crazy that movie even got made.
Oh my God, it's like a Hunter S. Thompson novel made in kid form.
It's as if like Hunter S. Thompson wrote an animated film and then Sam Peckinpah directed it. Like it's violent. It's grotesque.
It's crude.
It's crude, but it's like incredibly funny. And yeah, that movie is like a shit ton of fun. And it's not really a movie for kids. Because what kid's gonna like really get all those like old Western references that it has or Apocalypse Now and like all these like R-rated classic great movies that it references, and It is. It's a film that's. It's an animated film that's kind of made for fans of people who watch like Sam Peckinpah movies.
Right.
Which I'm in that category, and I that's why I like kind of adore that movie.
I think like lesson learned, and maybe this is the last. You know, my last thought is in terms of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and Lone Ranger. I think, you know, Gore Verbinski is like, he's got a distinct style to him, and he has these elements he likes to put in his films, but he's also, you know, he's also a journeyman filmmaker, and I think he's also like kind of respectable to like what he has to be making. So I think Pirates of the Caribbean and Lone Ranger, for all the weirdness, like the moments of weirdness that where those movies really come alive, they are unfortunately slavishly devoted to the Jerry Bruckheimer Disney like yes. template that mm-hmm. have been set. And so that's why those movies don't work.
That's why there's that push and pull yeah. constantly. And that's why I feel like
those, those movies are so in at war with themselves. And again, I think the first Pirates of the Caribbean people like because it's coherent. I think that's the thing that people remember most about that movie is that it's coherent and it's still way overlong, but it's relatively short compared to the other ones.
Oh yeah.
And sure. I think that's what people are holding on to, but you know, maybe look past the nostalgia or the memory, whatever it is. And just kind of like,
I kind of realized this franchise wasn't really that great to begin
it
with.
It really wasn't. And I think like when Gore Verbinski really gets to make a movie, when he gets to make a movie on his own devices, be it The Weatherman, be it Rango, be it mm-hmm. Cure for Wellness, which like I would put as his top three movies because he got the full creative reign to make.
Well, in a way, we get to see how much fun, how original like the Pirates movies or Lone Ranger could have been if he had full control by yes. watching Rango.
Yeah, absolutely.
That gives you a complete picture of like, oh, these movies could have been like crazy and fun like this. And but yeah, the whole Jerry Bruckheimer element kind of pulls it down because, yeah, he did have a lot more creative control on Rango, and I think that's by far the best of like Johnny Depp's weird kooky Johnny Depp performances, because he always plays a cartoon character anyway, so might as well have it be an actual cartoon.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And then it perfectly fits, you know. It's just yep. it's perfect for that. And yeah, I think people, apart from The Weatherman, that I feel like every chance I get, I've recommend that movie to people, because it's really like, you know, it was kind of a flop when it came out. It got really good reviews, I feel like, but it didn't get the kind of reverence that I thought it deserved, because it's a really like special film in terms of the way that it deals with modern adult existential life, and it's relatable and unique and personal. But at the same time, it's incredibly universal, mm-hmm. And that's a very hard thing to capture in a feature screenplay. So yeah, Gore Verbinski and definitely Stevie Conrad are just like knocked it out of the park with that one. And as we can see, those are kind of lightning in a bottle moments, and we should cherish them, because we see the other work that Gore Verbinski or Stevie Conrad is doing, and they're not up to the same level, perhaps because of the studio interference and all that stuff. So we see how incredibly talented and unique these people could be. And we also get to see like why they got to the places they are in the first place.
Yep.
And Weatherman is one of those kind of gems. And that's a hard film to, it would be a hard film to pull off these days.
I agree. And I'm happy it did. And you know, I feel like Pirates of the Caribbean existing helped get that movie get made the way it did.
Oh, yeah.
And if that's the case, so be it. I'm glad it exists.
I'm like, fine. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
If we got The Weatherman from that being, I don't care. Go hog wild. Have fun.
I'd rather be, if you're going to be like, you're not going to have Weatherman without Pirates, I'd be like, all right, I'll be bored with those three movies. Then
yeah.
If you're going to give me Weatherman, I'm totally fine with that. If you give me
one great movie.
One great movie out of those, I'm totally into it. Yeah, yeah. And then I would like really recommend, especially people who are into like just badass Western, just if you're into Leone and Peckinpah, just go rent Rango and have a great time.
I would agree. Well, should we wrap this up? What do you think?
Yeah, yeah, let's wrap it up. Thank you for listening to another episode of Over Under Movies. As usual, we are part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which also includes a bunch of other podcasts like our old co-host Eric McClanahan and podcast Adjusted Tracking that he does with Joe Van Oppen, and also we have Bingeworthy, and I think what the Indie Beat is another one. And then the regular Playlist podcast. So we have a bunch that you can check out, that you can subscribe on the Playlist podcast iTunes feed, and you can also find us on SoundCloud and on theplaylist.net. And as far as specifically Over Under Movies is concerned, you can find us on facebook.com/ Over Under Movies, and also you can find us on Twitter at Over Under Movies, and just, you know, send us, give us a comment and let us know how we're doing, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and all that good stuff. And before we get off, I would like to tease our next episode, which is going to be another one of our guest episodes. We're gonna grab another writer from the playlist to bring his picks over, and so our next episode we're gonna have Kenji Fujishima. He's a critic and contributor for the playlist as well as Paste Magazine. We're gonna have his picks, and it's gonna be an interesting, probably a heated and contested discussion, because his underrated pick is going to be, in my opinion, probably the one great American masterpiece of the last decade. Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood.
That's overrated.
Overrated. You said underrated. Oh yeah, overrated. It's wishful thinking. But yeah, that's going to be his overrated pick. So that's going to be kind of a interesting heated discussion, I think. And his underrated is going to be Martin Scorsese's The Aviator. So yeah, check out that episode when that comes along in about a couple weeks. But until then, I'd like to say goodbye and thank you for listening. This is Oktay Kozak. I'm a film critic and contributor to Paste Magazine. That's my new spot, and really excited for about writing there, and as well as theplaylist.net, DVD Talk, and BayasParada.com.
And I'm Ryan Oliver. You can find me here on the playlist at Over Under Movies, as well as the Playlist podcast.
Thank you, and as always, do not forget the tartar sauce.